Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the UN Climate Convention underway in Warsaw, Poland, where the pleas from the representative of the Philippines for the rich industrial countries to take responsibility for the damage that climate change is doing to the poorer countries are being ignored as Australia, Canada, and Japan renege on previous commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Janet Redmond, the director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies, joins us to discuss the moral and legal movements backwards by the haves at the expense of the have-nots. Then we'll look into the increasing chaos in Libya that has been the focus of a Republican obsession over the phony Benghazi scandal, while the larger issues of a country falling apart and a government running out of money are being ignored. Wayne White, a former State Department intelligence analyst on Libya, joins us to discuss the downward spiral of the already weak central government that is running out of oil revenues to pay off the militias to keep them loyal because of the chaos caused by the same marauding militias, some of whom are taking over the country's oil and gas facilities. Then finally, with progressive groups pushing for Elizabeth Warren to enter the 2016 presidential race to challenge the presumptive candidacy of Hillary Clinton, we will speak with Princeton historian Julian Zelizer about his article at CNN.com, Elizabeth Warren versus Hillary Clinton is a False Choice. We will discuss the possibility of a left versus center war amongst Democrats and the role of money in determining who will win the future battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. And joining us now is Janet Redmond, the co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she provides analysis of the international finance institutions' energy investment and carbon finance activities. Her recent studies on the World Bank climate activities include World Bank, Climate Profiteer, and Dirty is the New Clean, a critique of the World Bank Strategic Framework for Development and Climate Change. Welcome to Background Briefing, Janet Redmond.
Thank you so much for having me on today.
And the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change is underway in Warsaw, Poland. And one of the extraordinary things that I discovered in a conversation earlier with Jamie Henn of 350.org was that Cristiano Figueres, who's the head of the UN Climate Convention, it was also addressing a concurrent meeting of international coal companies, and she gave a keynote address. I was waiting to find out what she said at that keynote address. What have you learned from her comments? I mean, being there in the first place is in itself a little unsettling. So what did she have to say?
Well, you know, it is really, really disconcerting. Well, first of all, the World Coal Association would have a conference in parallel to the UN Climate Convention in Poland. And in fact, you had asked Christina Fierges, who is the secretariat of that convention, to join them at their youth summit, but said, you know, we'd like you to come only if you're serious about our future. So if you're going to be joining the coal convention, then we're not that excited about you coming. So she opted to go to the coal convention instead of the youth conference, which I think was a bit of a slap in the face to future generations. But I think what's even more concerning is what she said in her opening remarks to the Business Day, which is another parallel conference that's held by the private sector at the same time as the climate convention. And in those opening remarks, she actually said that coal is part of the solution to climate change. This is the mantra that the coal industry has been repeating over and over again in Warsaw, that, you know, coal is part of the energy future. It has to be part of the energy future, and it was very disappointing. And in fact, it was kind of alarming to have the chair of the climate conference, of the one international body that's concerned with fighting climate change, greenwash the dirtiest source of energy on the planet.
Well, but just by chanting a slogan doesn't make it a truth. And that's what I've always been astounded by, how the coal company have got away with this idea of clean coal, which is about as absurd a notion as a safe cigarette. Because the truth of the matter is that the only investment ever made in efforts to reduce the CO2 emissions from coal burning were actually done on the federal dime, and the coal industry has not put $1 into clean coal research, yet they keep talking about it as though it's real. When is somebody finally going to call them out on this canard?
I think that the trouble is that, of course, there have been people calling them out on the farce that is clean coal for a number of years, and those voices have really been the coming from the communities that are facing the entire life cycle of coal. So when people talk about clean coal, of course, they're only talking about the idea of capturing the CO2 emissions as it leaves a smokestack at a power plant and trying to pump that underground into geologic formations. It's called carbon capture and sequestration. It's actually it's a technology that hasn't been proven at a commercial scale. So it's still in the experimental phase. And yes, the public dime is paying for that. But I think what's really important is that even this idea of clean coal doesn't capture the reality of where coal is dirty. It's dirty when you dig it up. It's dirty when you blow up a mountain to try and get at it. It's dirty when you transport it across the country on trains that spread coal ash all over communities. Then it's also dirty when you burn it and you have to get rid of the fly ash that's a byproduct of a coal-fired power plant. So it's not just the CO2 emissions that are dirty. We have to look at a whole life cycle. So even if you only cared about climate change, the idea of clean coal is ridiculous. But if you actually care about human health and all the places that coal impacts people, then there really is no cleaning of coal across the board.
Again, I'm speaking with Janet Redman, who's the co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she provides analysis of the international financial institutions' energy investment and carbon finance activities. Her recent studies on the World Bank's climate activities include World Bank Climate Profiteer and Dirty is the New Clean, a critique of the World Bank Strategic Framework for Development and Climate Change. And again, we're talking about the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change conference underway in Warsaw, Poland. Now, I understand that some of the countries that have previously promised to reduce CO2 emissions, and of course in Australia, the outgoing government, the Labor government, put in a carbon tax, which the new Conservative government, although they're called Liberals, ran in opposition to and won, believe it or not. And the new Prime Minister of Australia is a climate change denier and a kind of equivalent of a Tea Party politician here in the United States. What's happening with Australia reneging, Canada's reneging, Japan's reneging? Give us a breakdown of who amongst the developed countries are backing away from their promises to do something, because we already have manifest evidence that the poorer countries like the Philippines are the victims of climate change resulting from the activities of the wealthier industrial countries.
Yeah, it's really a shame. I think for me, one of the most alarming and kind of, you know, really gut-wrenching aspects of this year's climate summit is that in the face of the worst quote-unquote natural weather-related disaster in the Philippines, developed countries are choosing to respond by backing away from their commitments. So, you know, Canada, under the Harper government, of course, withdrew from the Kyoto Protocol, which is the only international binding treaty to try to regulate greenhouse gases, climate-changing gases. Back in 2011, they pulled out because it was clear that they were going to miss their 2012 greenhouse gas target, and they never came back in. That's mostly because they've been massive expansion in tar sands, and they were going to break through that cap. So Canada was the first to kind of withdraw. And then this year, what was a shame was that, of course, yeah, the Prime Minister Tony Abbott made it very clear that that climate change was right in the crosshairs of his agenda. They repealed the carbon tax, as you said, and a study shows that actually their emissions will go up by 12% by 2020, which is the target year now that people are working on, instead of going down by 5% from 2000 levels. They've also, the Abbott government has also said, you know, we don't think it's really fair for us to have to help developing countries like our low-lying island neighbors adapt to climate change, deal with the impacts of climate change that we, the rich countries, have locked in. We'd like to see some other people pay for that. This is coming from the country that has the highest per capita greenhouse gas pollution on the planet. So what was really sad, of course, was then the Harper government congratulated the Australian government, saying what Australia is doing is a thing that all developed countries should do. It's the most realistic pathway. And then we had Japan announcing that they would change from a 25% reduction to a 3% reduction. So they've hugely cut back. As the fifth largest emitter of greenhouse gas pollution on the planet, that's a real shame. That's not to say that these folks are much worse than other governments. I mean, our own government here in the United States, there was a time, you know, what we're supposed to be doing is reducing our emissions by about 40% by the year 2020. Obama has made promises to cut by about 3 to 4% of those levels by 2020. So we're a laggard as well. We haven't announced anything this disappointing this round, but that's because we've been disappointing for quite a long time, unfortunately. I think at the heart of the matter is not just this problem of reducing emissions. So, you know, what's coming up in our near future is that 2015 is the year where we're all going to sign commitments. It will be the time of the new climate treaty. It's going to be kind of like a Copenhagen moment. The idea was that in 2015, countries were going to get serious. We were going to make serious commitments to cutting our greenhouse gas emissions. And then that would come into force in the year 2020. That's why all these folks are using projections for the 2020 target. What we're seeing instead is that, kind of folks are saying, we're not going to do that much. And in fact, we're going to do nothing between now and 2020. You know, we've got some legislation at home we're working on, but, our hands are tied and we're waiting to see what other people do first. So we're seeing this kind of, I don't know, what's the difference of the opposite of one upsmanship? I guess we're doing one downsmanship and saying, well, if you do less, then I'll do less too. And everyone's kind of racing to the bottom. And what's, right now is a climate crisis, as we've seen in the Philippines.
So, Janet Redman, is there a disconnect here between the individual's consciousness about their own carbon footprint and governments basically saying to hell with, science and let's just, party on? And like apparently the Australian Prime Minister feels that it's okay for Australians to have the worst carbon footprint on the planet. And in fact, let's, burn some more coal and burn some more gasoline and throw something more on the barbie,
Yeah, no, I think what's really interesting actually is that more and more people, even in right-wing constituencies in the United States, actually have kind of decided that the debate about whether climate change is happening or not is over. Most people actually accept the fact that we're in a warming world. The question is who's responsible and what we should do about it. So I think I can't imagine there's anyone in the United States or anyone anywhere in the world who would say on an individual level, yeah, I'm okay with driving this car if it means that people will die. No one's making that one-on-one connection, that one-to-one connection. So I think you're right that the challenge is making the mental leap from the cause and effect of my individual actions to taking collective political action to say to our governments that represent us, hey, we also don't want you condemning future generations and to be perfectly honest, generations, people living right now in most vulnerable countries to the impacts of a climate crisis. You can't do that in our name. I think part of the concern is that we have seen a false dichotomy set up for us, particularly by folks on the right, and that's the idea that we have to choose between the environment or jobs. So we can either choose climate or we can choose a stable economy, and that's really a false choice. No one knows this better than the insurance company, than the private sector, who has said, hey, climate change is really, really real. In fact, we need to see steep reductions in emissions fast unless we want to be paying a whole lot of money to try and protect ourselves, hedge our bets against climate impacts. So I think what we're seeing in the reality of the cost of Hurricane Sandy, the cost of bringing disaster relief to the Philippines, it reflects what the Federal Emergency Management Agency has already told us, which each dollar we spend right now in preventing disasters like floods, like the impacts from hurricanes, will save us $5 in disaster relief. The same is true for preventing out-of-control greenhouse gas. The more we spend now on reducing emissions, the less we'll have to spend later on adaptation and on compensating people in the developing world for the loss and damages to their lives and livelihoods later.
So does this require then a new thinking in terms of nationalism and patriotism? In other words, don't we have a greater allegiance to the planet as opposed to the nation? Because if the planet's in danger, it's an organism, a very frail one out in the middle of space, and there's nothing else around, and there's certainly no way to find anything else. We can't migrate off this planet, so we're all in the same boat. So you'd think that at a certain point, maybe there could be some way to develop a kind of new form of global patriotism as opposed to national patriotism?
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. I think this idea of choosing a kind of close the ranks response to a crisis versus let's find our common interest is exactly the problem. I guess I would even push a little further and say, you know, let's not focus just on a nation state and, you know, against them for us, but let's look at who is rigging the rules around climate, and that's really the private sector, and in particular the fossil fuel sector. I think this is incredibly apparent at the Warsaw Climate Convention right now. We're seeing an unprecedented representation of some of the most polluting industries on the planet. Heavy industry, coal, oil, gas are represented at the climate convention right now. But that's true even in our own country, of course. The fossil fuel industry pays big bucks toward elected officials. And it's not surprising that with that situation, we don't see a lot of climate legislation moving through either Congress or the state level. So I guess I would say let's worry less about directing our anger toward our nation state. Let's really take on the fossil fuel industry, which, to be perfectly honest, in some places is more powerful than national governments, and is certainly a much more consolidated force where they're consolidating both power and wealth. So I guess I would make the cry for all of us to unite and put the fossil fuel industry in its place, take back our national governments, take back our local governments, and get them to work toward our interests and the interests of future generations.
Well, Janet Redmond, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Janet Redmond, who's the co-director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network at the Institute for Policy Studies, where she provides analysis of the international financial institutions, energy investments, and carbon finance activities. Her recent studies on the World Bank climate activities include World Bank Climate Profiteer and Dirty is the New Clean, a critique of the World Bank's strategic framework for development and climate change. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into the chaos in Libya.